From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, Donald Glover, the creator and star of the FX series Atlanta. He plays a Princeton dropout who's broke and wants to manage his cousin's rap career. First, he has to convince his cousin he needs a manager.
Look, I'm not dumb. You're older. You have no real fan base. You're not white and or selling sex.
The cousin hasn't made money rapping. He makes a living selling drugs. But he says he raps because he has to.
I scare people at ATMs, boy. I have to rap. I mean, that's what rap is, making the best out of a bad situation, bro.
Glover wrote for 30 Rock, played Troy Barnes on the series Community, does stand-up, and raps under the name Childish Gambino. He was nominated for 2 Grammys. Also, Maureen Carrigan reviews the 3rd and final volume of renowned feminist Blanche Wiesenkook's biography of Eleanor Roosevelt. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Donald Glover, created, co-writes, and stars in the FX series Atlanta, which is a hybrid of comedy and drama set on the fringes of Atlanta's hip-hop scene. The first season's finale is tonight. Glover plays Earn, short for Ernest, a Princeton dropout who's broke. When we first meet him, he has an alienating job working at an airport kiosk trying to sign people up for a credit card. He comes up with an idea that he hopes will be a way out, managing the music career of his cousin Alfred, an underground rapper who performs under the name Paperboy but makes his living selling drugs. Earn is the perpetual outsider, whether it's in the hip-hop world or his own family. He's on the outs with his parents because he's asked them for money too many times, and his on-and-off-again girlfriend, who's the mother of his young daughter, is often fed up with him, although she usually lets him live at her place since he doesn't have one of his own. Although Donald Glover's character doesn't rap, Glover does. He records under the name Childish Gambino. He's received 2 Grammy nominations. He's also a stand-up comic, wrote for 30 Rock, and played Troy on the comedy series Community. Let's start with a scene from the first episode of Atlanta, when Earn first tries to convince his cousin to let him be his manager. Earn is at his cousin's house. His cousin's friend and roommate Darius is there, too. The cousin, Paperboy, is played by Brian Tyree Henry. Darius is played by Lakeith Stanfield.
So, Zoo Tycoon.
You want in on Paperboy?
What? No?
Please, man. People ain't just nice, Earn. When was the last time you were nice to a girl you weren't trying to smash?
This morning?
You talking about your daughter, man. That's gross.
No, it would be gross if I was trying to smash. I don't want a handout. I want to manage you.
Manage? You know where the word manage come from?
Manus, Latin for hand.
Probably, but I'm gonna say no for the purpose of my argument. Manage come from the word man, and that ain't really your lane.
My lane?
Yeah, man, I need Malcolm. You too, Martin. You know what they did to him? They killed him.
Didn't they kill Malcolm, too?
Well, no, they say that, but ain't nobody seen a body since the funeral.
That's how funerals work. Alfred, you already Malcolm, okay? You have that already. What you really need is a silent wild card, somebody who's about the money, the opportunity, who can play both sides if needed.
Oh, like Don Lemon.
Fair point. Let me rephrase what I'm trying to say.
Oh, wait. It's 4:30.
Oh, damn, man, we late.
Donald Glover, welcome to Fresh Air. I think it's interesting that you decided not to cast yourself as the rapper in this and to make it not about the kind of rap that you do, which is a more personal, reflective kind of rap expressing insecurities with lots of pop culture references. So tell us why you decided not to make this about you as a rapper, but as about someone who's a rapper who's very different from you.
I probably chose that because I just thought that I wouldn't want to watch that. I thought that'd be a bad show.
The show about you as a rapper?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to watch that. And also, I don't want to blur that line. Like, I enjoy blurring mm-hmm. a lot of things, but I feel like that line is just not enjoyable to blur.
How would you describe Paperboy as a rapper?
Paperboy's, you know, he's like a real dope boy rapper. He's like a real Atlanta, like, dope boy rapper, like, kind of archetypical dope boy rapper that me and my brother kind of grew up on, like, that kind of feel where it's like, yeah, like, you know, almost like hood famous, like they're in your neighborhood, but you also hear them on the radio because they're famous for, you know, selling, but also just like, you know, coming up with something catchy.
Although Paperboy carries a gun and sells drugs to make money, he mm-hmm. doesn't fit the stereotype that he seems to be portraying. You know, like mm-hmm. he doesn't want to see kids carrying guns. He really resents that he's famous for being implicated in a shooting. So instead of trying to exploit it, he just like resents the attention that he's getting for that. It's an interesting contradiction, you know, it's an interestingly complex character.
I think a lot of people, you look at like, I think people that we kind of based him off of, whether it's like Jeezy or Gucci Mane or like, you know, those kind of dudes, they're not in it really trying to glorify, you know, like they're just talking about what's actually happening. Like it's hard. Like you can't sell drugs once you get famous as much. You can't do it as easily as it was. Like they kind of, and I think Paperboy's kind of figuring that out too. It's like, you know, like making music is fun and like selling drugs makes money, you know, And then, like, I think people forgot that people actually make music for fun. Like, the funds you make from, like, drugs allow you to do something that no one pays you to do really anymore. Music isn't, he says it in, like, episode 3, where he's like, there's no money anywhere near rap. And, like, that's true. Like, it's not a way of making money. So I think it's a kind of a hard balance that, like, actual people go through. I think, like, the stereotype of rappers, like, loving that life and, like, glorifying it as far as, like, wanting everybody to live that way, I think that's just, like, a false stereotype.
The series starts with the main characters in a car outside a club. Two people walk by, smash the side view mirror, and Paperboy gets out of the car with his gun. Your character follows him. A shot goes off. It fades to black. We don't know who fired the shot or who got hurt. Why did you want to start it that way?
It didn't seem boring. I thought, like, it was like an honest altercation. And it was the beginning of that universe. I think that just, like, that set of, like, those three kind of, like, are tied together.
After the shooting, Earn, your character, and Paperboy are in the police station waiting to be booked. And everyone there is acting kind of like it's a bad day at the DMV. And they have to deal with this awful bureaucracy. And they've been here before. And they know the way the game is played. And they don't want to be there, but it's something you have to endure. And the people who work there seem to have the same attitude. And it's portrayed as just being like a routine part of life. Not so much for your character, who seems newer to it.
Yeah, he's never done it.
Yeah. So, like, where does that scene come from? That kind of attitude of, like, yeah, that's what happens.
I think it is kind of humdrum when you're poor.
Mm-hmm.
Jail is just time out for adults. You know, that's really what it is. And I think the people in it, like, it's not, like, harrowing. Like, when you see, like, we tried really hard to make the jail look as boring as it actually is. Like, even usually when you see a jail, it's, like, people behind bars and, like, their, like, hands are sticking out and they're, like, yelling and people are, like, quiet down in there and, like, it's, like, active. But it's not. It is humdrum. It is, like, the DMV, like, which is, like, the same setup. But we tried to make it feel as boring as it is, like, you have all these characters in there that are interesting, but the actual thing of, like, jail is just people being like, okay, like, let's put you in this system so it's easier to bring you back in this system. And, you know, it sucks that we have to be here. We all would like to be, you know, at the beach right now or somewhere else. And I think, like, probably the people working there are kind of like, yeah, I don't like this place either, like, but, you know, how else are we gonna eat?
And do you know this from, like, going there for research or having been there waiting to be booked for something or having friends tell you about it?
Two of the writers spent the night in jail, and that was, like, the feeling. They said it was, like, you know, it's weird because they make you, you know, the way they're describing it is for, which is the reality for most people, is, like, you know, you get sent in there sometimes on something that's super bogus, and then they have you sit down, and then they tell you you can't sleep, even though it's like even my character says that. It's like, but everybody always has slept. Like, how can you make us not sleep in here? Especially when it's taking hours upon hours for you to do what we need you to do to just move on. You know, it's a very, like, weird power dynamic. And people are just, like, looking for fun. It's like going to ISS when you're a kid. But, yeah, it came from, like, a personal experience of two of the writers. Steven, my brother.
Oh, yeah, your brother. Your brother actually does the, should I call it the title rap for the series? The track called Paperboy. That's your brother doing it, right?
Yeah, that's my brother. Yeah, rapping. Yeah, it's a pretty catchy song. He did a good job.
Did you write it or did he write it?
I just wrote, like, the hook. Like, I was, like, wrote the hook and, like, had some, like, lines. But, like, one thing that we were trying to do was, like, you know, we wanted it to be something that felt real, you know, so we tried to make this super simple. Like, what would be something that would be just fun and not try and make it, like, oh, the best song ever. So, like, oh, just, like, kind of a hood anthem. So we were, like, you know, something that feels like it wrote itself, which is, you know, paperboy, all about that paperboy. Like, you know, play with the pun of it, or, you know, getting paper and paperboy. It just felt very, like, easy, and you weren't overthinking it. And then, you know, when we were in the studio, he was like, yeah, the rest kind of wrote itself. It's easy.
Would you object if we played it?
No, I would not object.
Okay, so let's hear the track Paperboy, which ends one of the episodes of Atlanta. And this is performed by Stephen Glover, who raps under the name Stephen G. Lover.
Mm-hmm.
Did I get that right?
Steve G. Lover.
Steve G. Lover, right, okay. Yeah. Great.
I'm sorry.
What? I'm sorry.
This is really surreal to hear Terry Gross saying Steve G. Lover. like my brother's rap name. Like, is that right?
Do I have that right? Is that correct, sir? So here it is.
Paperboy, always about that paperboy. If you ain't on your grind, then you flexing, you's a hater boy. Paperboy, always getting paperboy. If you ain't making money, then you ain't a money maker boy. Paperclip, yeah, I need a paperclip. I'm stacking up this paper, man, and I can make that paper flip, that paper flip.
So that's Paperboy, which is the song that is the kind of theme song for the character Paperboy on the series Atlanta, which was created and stars my guest Donald Glover. So we need to take a short break here, and then we'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Donald Glover, and he's the creator, co-writer, sometimes director, and star of the FX series Atlanta. The season finale is this evening, and the series is about a rapper whose cousin, and the cousin is played by Donald Glover, is kind of drifting and has a really terrible job and decides what he should really do is try to represent his cousin as his cousin's manager in the music world. Mm-hmm. So among the things you satirize in the series is a couple who are in the upper class. It's an African-American wife and a white husband, and they live in this kind of like mansion, and they're having a Juneteenth party. Do you want to explain the setup of this episode?
Van is the mother of Ernst's child. Van is trying to get in good, I guess, to like get a better job or like get a new job, and with a friend of hers or an associate who is like the head of, you know, like basically like has a lot of upper class friends who can get her job, and she has a husband who's white and, you know, is very into black culture. And yeah, like the whole thing takes place at like a Juneteenth party in Atlanta, and like that, and I guess in like a rich neighborhood, probably somewhere like, you know, in Gwinnett or something.
And the white husband has been showing off to your character how much he knows about black culture and African history and African American history. And your character is just getting really exasperated being preached to by this white guy.
Well, I mean, it's funny. Like, I felt like that episode really struck with a lot. Like, I had a lot of white guys say, like, I don't know how to feel about this episode. I think it struck a chord, probably. Like, it's just kind of weird. Because, like, I think they kind of felt like he was doing all the right things. Like, he wasn't a mean guy, you know. And I think, you know, that's the funny part, that's the interesting part. It's like, yeah, it wasn't about him being nice or mean. Like, he didn't, you know, depending on who you are, how you feel, like, he probably didn't do anything wrong. It's just, you know, there's a lot. I think that episode fully exemplifies why it's so hard to be like, racism's over. You know, it's just, like, tied into so many feelings and emotions and that we're not really... I don't know if we're ready to talk about them yet,
Well, why don't we hear a clip from this episode? And your character and the mother of your character's daughter are there trying to have this really like respectable vibe, and which means that you can't say what it is you really do when you're just managing your cousin's rap career. You're pretending that that's not what you do. But then you're kind of outed because the two valets recognize you because they're big fans of Paperboy and they want you to sign their girlfriend's underwear, as I recall.
they wanted me to take their sister's underwear and give it to Paperboy because she likes him.
Right. Okay. So when that happens, the white husband realizes, oh, that's how I know you. And that leads to a conversation where the African-American wife is kind of appalled that you're actually involved in the rap world. So why don't we hear a scene from that episode? And this is right when the white husband realizes, oh, you're the guy who manages Paperboy.
I knew it. I knew you from somewhere. I had such a special feeling about you, Earn. Honey, Earn is Paperboy's manager. Oh, sorry. A very, very talented young rapper.
Oh, you manage rap?
Yes, I manage rap.
There is nothing wrong with earning money doing something with rap. It's fine.
Well, it's not just about money. You know, he's my cousin. He's family.
Yeah, honey, you're missing the point. It's not about money. This is bigger than money. Paperboy is underground. I've been following Paperboy since the start. That's how I knew you. I mean, since the shooting, your pictures were everywhere.
Shooting? Well, you're gonna shoot up this party. Are you, Erin?
No, I wasn't planning on it.
I'm kidding. I get it. Can't choose your family, huh? Every decent person is at least one trifling thug in the family. Oh, buddy, let's go say hello to something.
Nah, I'm sorry. This is whack. This is whack. Nah. Okay, this isn't real life. Okay, this party is dumb. She's dumb. This is all dumb. You know that, man.
Okay.
This is dumb.
Sorry. We're gonna head out.
And you know what? Stop stunning on me about my culture. Like, I'm not gonna go back to Africa and find my roots because, you know what? I'm broke, dude. I'm broke.
It's my bad.
No, don't do that. And stop being so likable. Like, I get, don't, and don't be like, I understand. Because you don't understand.
We're going now.
Good night.
Okay, well, we'd love to see you soon. Thank you very much for coming. Mm-hmm.
Good night. Mm-hmm. Happy Juneteenth.
So was it cathartic for you to to play Earn just kind of like trying to tell the truth about his feelings?
I definitely knew where Earn was coming from. I definitely see Earn's point of view, which is kind of like, you know, it's almost not fair that, you know, this guy's an optometrist and he knows more about my, you know, what stuff I should know or like should have learned, but because of years of unfairness and things going, I just don't know, you know, and I probably won't have that chance. And he's kind of taking, and even though he's super, I guess, respectful or, you know, super aware of his, in a weird way, of his privilege, it's annoying to Earn.
It's also that this guy is showing off so hard about how much he knows about Black history.
Yeah, and I think he actually genuinely, he's goofy, definitely.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
that
definitely
guy's kind of corny.
Yeah.
I think he genuinely likes it. You know, like, I think he genuinely, but that's the thing, he has the option to dig in. Like, he could have done that with, like, Nordic history. Like, that's what I think Earn is probably upset about. It's like he just happened to choose that. I think he genuinely, I don't even think he's trying to show off to Earn. I think he's really into that stuff. And he's like, oh, Earn gets it because Earn is Black, you know.
So where did you grow up in Atlanta?
I grew up in a suburb called Stone Mountain. Yeah, it's up, like, east of Atlanta.
And tell us about the neighborhood.
It was I think when we first moved there, it was you know, just like a pretty like standard suburb. There weren't a lot of black people there when we moved in, but I guess within the first, I'd say like 3 or 4 years, like white flight happened. And yeah, it became predominantly black by the time I was in high school.
Were you conscious of that happening when you were young?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, the whole reason we were moving there was for that reason. Like, my mom was trying to get us into a better school system. Like, even the fact that like a lot of like the kids in the neighborhood, like I remember like a lot of, I had never really heard of soccer, and there were like a lot of kids who were playing soccer when I first got there, and I was like, oh, soccer. That's different.
My guest is Donald Glover. He created, co-writes, and stars in the FX series Atlanta. The season one finale is tonight. We'll talk more after a break, and Maureen Carrigan will review the third and final volume of a biography of Eleanor Roosevelt by feminist historian Blanche Wiesen Cook. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Stitch Fix, a personal styling service for men and women designed to evolve with their clients' tastes, needs, and lifestyle, and on their schedule. Learn more at stitchfix.com. And from TIAA, whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Donald Glover. He created, co-writes, and stars in the FX series Atlanta. He also directed some of the episodes. The first season's finale is tonight. Glover has done improv and stand-up. He wrote for 30 Rock and played Troy on the comedy series Community. He's also appeared in the films The Martian and Magic Mike XXL. He also records under the name Childish Gambino and has received 2 Grammy nominations. When we left off, we were talking about growing up just outside of Atlanta. So your parents were Jehovah's Witnesses, or are Jehovah's Witnesses?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So how did that affect? I think your parents, from what I know, didn't want you to watch TV, or at least not a lot of TV. But you seem so absorbed in all kinds of pop culture. It seems like it's really important to you. So was it frustrating for you as a kid to not be able to watch what you wanted to watch, or maybe listen to what you wanted to listen to?
Sometimes. Sometimes it was a little frustrating just because you wanted to be part of the, you wanted to be part of the gang, like you wanted to be part of the group.
Yeah, that's the, you know, that's what holds people together. I mean, when you're kids, but also often when you're an adult, you share, like you share, you know, certain shows or websites or, you know, music or whatever, movies.
Yeah, like it's hard. I definitely remember, you know, going to school and people talking about In Living Color and me being like, man, like, I really wish I could watch that. Like, I was like, it sounded really good, like, references. Like, and I would piece, it actually was kind of helpful because you would kind of piece together jokes that you would hear, and then, like, I'd come up with my own through what I heard. It forced me to be a little bit more imaginative about culture, I guess. Like, what things could be as opposed to what things were.
That's funny because it means it helped you become a creator of the kind of material you weren't allowed to watch.
Right, I know. Yeah. I think the thing, like, my parents were like, they were like, you know, Bart Simpson's a bad influence. Like, The Simpsons were no go. And, like, I think that was, like, that album was, like, one of the first albums, like, I listened to.
Oh, really the album of songs from The Simpsons?
Yeah, like, it had, like, the Bartman on it and, you know, all, like, it was great. And I think Lisa Simpson sings, like, God Bless a Child That Has His Own. And I remember being like, oh, this is all cool. But it's all through, like, The Simpsons. Like, it was funny.
I'm not sure if that's the one or not that also has the musical based on Streetcar Named Desire.
Oh, yeah. I had that album, too. I think the first one was, like, a legit kind of album. It had the Bartman and, like, a couple of the things. And then there was an album that came out later that had, like, all the songs, like, the Mr. Burns, like, buying, like, clothes made out of animals and that the Streetcar Named Desire, like, and, yeah, that one had, like, tons of tracks on it. But the first one, which was just, like, kind of, like, I think people realizing what a huge phenomenon the Simpsons was, I was, like, obsessed with it.
Your parents were foster parents when you were growing up. So how often did you have foster children at home who were part of your family?
I can't remember a time we didn't.
Were they of different ages?
Yeah, they would come in and out. Some would stay for months, some would stay for weeks, some would stay for years. Sometimes they'd be like teenagers, sometimes they'd be like babies. It was a wide range.
How did that work out for you?
It was great. Like, you know, you got to meet, I mean, every type of kid, and you also got to see what was happening in the city through children, like people, your kids your age. You know, we were, you know, like, we had like when AIDS was like a thing. Like, when it was becoming, like, before it was called HIV, like, when it was, like, had just stopped being called GRID, like, we had, like, you know, AIDS patients and, like, who were kids staying with us. And, like, I remember, like, it was, like, very, you know, to be reading about it and hearing about it in school and hearing, like, actual people talk about it is, like, completely different from living and experiencing it through with a child.
Because you're a comic, a writer, a rapper, an actor, you get to express what you want to say in different forms, in different mediums. So I want to play an excerpt of a comedy special that you did in 2010 on Comedy Central. And this is an excerpt in which you're talking about being a black nerd. And it starts off with you talking about President Obama.
The best part about Obama is that he's a black nerd. I love that jump. Because I'm a black nerd, and that was illegal until like 2003. It's awesome. It's so awesome. It's just like there's black nerds everywhere, you know, like it's awesome. It's just like they're everywhere now. It's so great. And I love it. But it was just hard for us growing up. Like, you know, I remember I was like the only black kid at my school for a while. Like, I remember I went to a white school, and white kids were excited. They were super excited. They were like, oh, we got a black kid. This is awesome. We got a black kid. They were like, hey, Donald, what kind of rap music you into, and what kind of sneakers you like? And I was like, oh, I don't really like rap music. I really enjoy the soulful stylings of the Cranberries. We can talk about that. And they were like, nah, man, you like sneakers, and you like rap music, and you go, tell us which one you like. I was like, oh, you're hurting me, Steven, you know?
That's my guest, Donald Glover. So, okay, so my impression, knowing you only through your work and not as a person, you know, outside of your work, my impression would be that you felt you had black friends and white friends telling you who you were supposed to be, and you weren't fitting into anybody's projections. You were going your own way.
Yeah, I think it's I mean that's pretty accurate. I think it's just, you know, also like having time to, like, you know, you got to think about when you're like, when you're 10, like, versus like now, or even like when you're 50, like, who are you really? I think, I know that sounds very, that's very spacey or like very like, just like, who am I, you know? But yeah, you're only really you when you're alone, you know, when you're not basing it off of other people or expectations and stuff. So I feel like, it's a weird thing. And I think people always ask about what I do. And they, a lot of people ask, like, you know, which one's your favorite? Or like, which one do you relate to the most? And I always, it's hard for me to, I get asked that all the time. And I'm always like, I don't see them as separate things. I'm just going to, like, play them out, you know, with people and be who I am at that time and not ask questions about it.
Well, we need to take a short break here, so let me reintroduce you first. If you're just joining us, my guest is Donald Glover and is the creator and star of the FX series Atlanta. It has its season finale this evening. He also raps under the name Childish Gambino. He co-starred on Community and wrote for 30 Rock. So we're going to take a short break and then be right back. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the law firm Cooley LLP. With offices in the U.S., Europe, and China, Cooley advises entrepreneurs, investors, financial institutions, and established companies around the world, where innovation meets the law. And from Squarespace, an all-in-one website builder for bringing a project, business, or portfolio to life online with templates, custom domains, and 24/7 support. Learn more at squarespace.com.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Donald Glover. He created and stars in the FX series Atlanta. Donald Glover is also a rapper. He raps under the name Childish Gambino. He's also a comic, and he co-starred in Community and wrote for 30 Rock. So what came first for you? Was it comedy or writing?
I guess, they're kind of the same thing. I would just say music, mm-hmm. as a language was like the first thing. I just remember a lot of songs being as a child. You know, there's a lot of pictures of me as a child, like with a Walkman, like listening all the time, which I didn't realize that I didn't remember. But now that, you know, when I look back, I'm like, oh man, I listen to music like all the time.
What's some of the things that made the biggest impression on you?
My dad's collection. My dad really liked, he really liked Funkadelic and Prince. And like anything he was listening to, I would listen to.
It's funny, like Prince was a Jehovah's Witness, although a lot of parents thought his songs were like too dirty. But so were you allowed to listen to Prince because he was a witness?
No, I was allowed to listen to him because my dad was like, I'm not giving that up. I think that just the contradiction just played a part in that, where it's the way we live. You know, Prince can make, like, you sexy, but he can also make Seven. You know, Seven is like probably my favorite spiritual song ever. Like the beginning of that song is so powerful. It makes your heart kind of stop or something, and like, you know, in order to write that and sing that, you kind of have to have that inside of you, and you have to also be at peace with the fact that, you know, I can write the opposite as well.
So after performing arts school, you went to NYU. You studied dramatic writing there. So what were you thinking your future was going to be at that time?
I think I had aspirations of, like, oh, maybe I'll write for, like, Mad TV or, like, SNL. And I think that was, like, kind of it. Like, I think, you know, I went into dramatic writing because, like, I think I got the most money, like, for scholarship that way, even though I kind of knew,
right.
like, I kind of knew, like, writing plays wasn't going to be the move just because, I mean, like, unless I wanted to be, like, you know, the special snowflake black writer who, like, writes these, like, very specific, like, plays and, like, lives in, like, Manhattan. I was just, I mean, like, not to say, like, it's about money, but I was just, like, I just didn't see, like, I didn't see myself doing that, but it definitely, like, allowed me to, like, experience New York.
Well, you did do sketch comedy and improv in college and maybe after as well. And one of the groups you were in was the Upright Citizens Brigade, which is, I think, what landed you your first TV job writing for 30 Rock, because Amy Poehler was one of the co-founders of Upright Citizens Brigade. And of course, she's very close with Tina Fey, and Tina Fey is a creator of 30 Rock. So that's how you got.
Yeah, I was part of a scholarship program at UCB. Well, I guess not scholarship, but like you you like intern there, like you clean toilets and they pay you in classes.
So Tina Fey has said that when she brought you on to 30 Rock, that you were the only African-American writer at the show at the time, but that the real diversity you brought was that you were their only, quote, cool young person who could tell them what the kids were listening to these days. Because you came from a large family in Georgia, you were also helpful in writing for the character Kenneth the Page, because the character's from Georgia. So do you remember being used that way, as like the cool young person who could tell them what kids were listening to these days?
Yeah, you know, they used to ask me questions like we'd be going about that. And I remember once I pitched a joke about like Tracy wearing a T-shirt with a black Bart Simpson on it, or like some joke about that. And I remember Robert, who was like the head writer, he was like, "That's funny." And it was like dot dot dot. Like he's like, "Is that a real thing?" And then, like, I got it, like, started explaining. I'm like, well, yeah, like, you know, you go to, like, in Atlanta anyway. I was like, yeah, you go to the mall, like, South Cat Mall, and they have, like, you know, black versions of characters, like, drawn on the T-shirts, and, like, they were cool. And, like, it was weird because I was like, one of the first times I was like, oh, this is completely different world from, I know something that, like, these people didn't know existed, which was really, I don't know, it was interesting to find out.
So after, I don't know how long, you decided to leave 30 Rock because you decided you wanted to perform. That must have been a really hard decision to make, because, you know, writing for 30 Rock is it's a really great job, and you were in your 20s, probably in your early 20s. I think you were 21 when you were hired, and you were still living in an NYU dorm working as an RA. So did you think, like, this might be really stupid, but I'm going to quit anyways? You know what I mean? It's really risky to have such a great job and decide that you want to pursue something different.
It's only risky if you were happy there.
You weren't?
You know? No, I mean, like, I had a great time, like, and I learned a ton. And I really loved all the people there. And, like, I don't know, I don't think I've... You know, they're some of the funniest people and the smartest people I work with. But I just knew I didn't want to stay there. I never saw it as risky, just because I was like, oh, like, if I know the answer as far as, like, oh, do I want to stay here? Like, no. Then why stay? Like, I don't know. Like, it was probably... It was just like an honest decision. Like I didn't second guess it, because like I just knew I wasn't going to do what was expected of me there, which was like, I guess, become, you know, go move higher and higher in the ranks and become like a showrunner or something. I'm not sure what would have happened, but I knew it just wasn't for me.
So another question about Atlanta. My impression is, and this might be totally off, so you can just tell me if it is, that your parents worked really hard to kind of move to a suburban neighborhood and to always make sure you were in good schools, even if that meant traveling a big distance to a magnet school. And Atlanta, I kind of have a feeling, is set in the world that your parents didn't want you to be a part of, that your parents tried to get you out of by moving to a suburb, by sending you to special schools.
I mean, yeah, they just want, I mean, like, they definitely wanted me to have, like, a better education. Like, that was a big deal to them. Like, the best education that they could afford, you know. We didn't have a lot of money. So, you know, it had to be magnet school, like, and most of it, maybe we had to test in or something. But, I mean, like, the actual, like, things in Atlanta, like, it was interesting. It was, like, I don't think they were trying to keep me away from what was actually happening in Atlanta, because like we had foster kids, and those kids were they would tell us, or like I'd see what was happening, you know, like I'd mm-hmm. meet their parents, like I'd see what drugs do, like I'd see how, you know, I'd see all that stuff, you know, and they're from New York, so they understood, like, you know, you need to be malleable.
So real quick, last question.
Mm-hmm.
So your rap name, Childish Gambino, famously came from the Wu-Tang name generator. And when the name Childish Gambino came up, did any part of you go, oh, no, really? That? I have to use that?
Oh, no.
Yeah?
That was the coolest one that came out.
Oh, you tried multiple times, huh?
No, like my friends were doing it. And all of theirs were kind of like sillier. And then everybody was like, that one was like the coolest one. Like, it just felt the most, like, you know, it felt like it told a story the most, you know, like it kind of sounds like, you know, a kid turning into a boss. Like, it sounds like the name kind of sounds like a journey, which I like.
Well, Donald Glover, thank you so much. I look forward to season 2 of Atlanta whenever that comes back.
Thank you. It's nice to finally audio meet you.
Donald Glover created, writes, and stars in the FX series Atlanta. The first season's finale is tonight. The show has already been renewed for a second season. Glover's upcoming films include Spider-Man Homecoming and the Han Solo Star Wars movie, where Glover will play a young Lando Calrissian. Coming up, Maureen Carrigan reviews the 3rd and final volume of Blanche Wieson Cook's biography of Eleanor Roosevelt. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Our book critic Maureen Carrigan has a review of the 3rd and final volume of a biography of Eleanor Roosevelt by the renowned feminist historian Blanche Wieson Cook. The first volume was published in 1992.
Last things first. One of the most extraordinary aspects of the 3rd volume of Blanche Wieson Cook's monumental biography of Eleanor Roosevelt is the way it ends. I don't think I've ever read another biography where the death of the subject is noted in an aside of less than 10 words on the second to last page of the book. Bear in mind that with this 3rd and concluding volume, Cook has devoted almost 2,000 pages to the life of Eleanor Roosevelt. Yet she compacts Eleanor's post-White House years into a brief epilogue, and says nothing about the personal struggles that Eleanor faced as a widow or the physical challenges she contended with as she aged. Cook doesn't even mention the cause of Eleanor's death on November 7, 1962. You have to look elsewhere to find out that she was ill for the final 2 years of her life and that tuberculosis was the culprit. This abrupt ending to a biography whose publication has stretched over almost a quarter of a century speaks to both Blanche Wiesen Cook's priorities as well as to Eleanor's. In earlier volumes, Cook described Eleanor's emotionally deprived childhood and delved into the complex marital partnership that evolved between Eleanor and Franklin. Cook also explored what she controversially identified as an erotic friendship between Eleanor and reporter Lorena Hickok. But her primary concern as a biographer has been on Eleanor's growth into a savvy, impassioned activist, particularly on behalf of New Deal programs and civil rights. In this volume, the reach of Eleanor's activism expands to refugee rescue and the founding of the United Nations. Privately, Eleanor continued to battle bouts of depression that she had suffered most of her life. She called these episodes her Griselda moods. But you get the sense in this final volume of Cook's biography that Eleanor, as she grew into the towering role of First Lady of the world, was more determined than ever to keep herself so engaged that even death, when it came calling, would have to take a number and wait. Cook's particular focus here is on the war years, when, as she succinctly explains, the partnership between Eleanor and Franklin shifted as the president turned away from his domestic programs. In the past, Eleanor had gone to the public to argue on behalf of FDR's New Deal programs, to build support for things a reluctant and divided Congress tried to hobble. Now, Eleanor increasingly went to the public to argue for her own version of what was right and essential. Eleanor's homeland concerns, like fair housing laws and the relaxing of quotas on immigration, ensured that she and her so-called pink pals would be constant targets of anti-communists. "To know me is a terrible thing," Eleanor commented after a particularly ruthless episode in which friends had to resign from an arts and education program she championed. When America entered the war, Eleanor traveled to blitz-ravaged London and flew across the Pacific to visit servicemen in Bora Bora, Samoa, and Guadalcanal. Even there, she continued her campaigns against racism, visiting and shaking hands with Negro servicemen. Cook quotes the recollections of a Black Army private who was eating an ice cream cone when Eleanor appeared in the Negro canteen. "She looked straight into my eyes and said, 'May I have some of that ice cream?' According to his account, Eleanor took a big bite of the cone and handed it back to him. Cook doesn't elaborate, so without further digging, there's no way to tell whether reporters were trailing Eleanor at that moment or whether it was a simple act of human connection between a first lady and a serviceman. Either way, it was a radical gesture for that age. Volume 3 of Cook's biography of Eleanor Roosevelt is packed with many other revealing small incidents, as well as detailed accounts of her tireless work on behalf of progressive causes. The list of committees alone that claimed Eleanor as a chair or active member could constitute an entire chapter here. I've read all 3 volumes of Cook's biography, and taken together, they present an exhausting and exhilarating story, as well as an undeniably melancholy one. In her relentless efforts to push American democracy to fulfill its promises, Eleanor Roosevelt was ahead of her time. As we ponder our curdled political culture on the eve of Election Day, it's not at all clear that we have yet caught up to her.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Eleanor Roosevelt, Volume 3, by Blanche Wiesen Cook. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, my guest will be Stephen Colbert. The Late Show with Stephen Colbert will be preempted on CBS election night, so he's doing a live election night special on Showtime, where he promises...
someone will be buck naked.
We'll talk about why he ended the Colbert Report, what it's been like to do a late night show without being in persona, and how he's been covering the election. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Mooj Zadie. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Audible, provider of audiobooks on topics ranging from astronomy to zombies. More information at audible.com/listen. Audible, stories that surround you. And from Staples, offering a variety of printer ink and toner cartridges for home or business printers, and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen. We'll be right back.